Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
Friday morning, political panel time. Always looking forward to this, and I know you do too. Well, most of you. And joining our panel this morning, Olivia Pearson. Great to have you back, Olivia.
Oh, good morning, fellas. Thanks for having me back.
Lee Taituha. Nice to have you back, Lee.
G'day. Good to see you.
And I won't laugh. Cam Slater. Hi, Cam.
Hey, how are you, Paul? Good morning, everybody.
I'm good. How was your show yesterday?
It was a whole heap of fun, actually. I kind of got to do a redo on the debate over tobacco policy and spoke to Eric Crampton. What a brain on that guy. He just knows all the numbers, and then he looks at it from an economic perspective. You know, like if you want to change people's, you know, way of thinking around this, there's ways that you can do it with signals and all of that sort of thing. He makes it easy to understand the economics of what tobacco control policy settings are all about. So,
It's making people go broke because it's so damn expensive.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing, you know, and you've got products that are, and this is the bit that gets me, right? We've got products out there that are much less harmful. Now, there can be some debate over whether there's still harm, but life is harmful, right? But there's options that are less harmful, and yet we've got all these health professionals that are saying, oh, no, we need to tax those as harshly as tobacco. When they're not burning, they're not actually containing.
They just don't like the act of it. That's their problem. They don't care anything more than that. They just don't want to see people indulging in that sort of thing.
They've morphed the argument. Yeah, this is what annoys me is they've morphed the argument away from smoking tobacco is bad for your health. And we all agree on that, right? Even you, Paul, who's, you know, been a smoker and now vapes. And me, who smokes cigars and pipes. But we all agree that smoking and burning tobacco and inhaling that stuff is bad for you.
Yeah.
But they've changed the whole narrative now, and it's nicotine that's awful.
Yeah.
But nicotine saved my life. And so I'll die in a ditch defending nicotine all day long. There's demonstrable health benefits from nicotine. Yes, it's addictive.
It's that neuroplasticity, isn't it, Cam?
We all need it.
You know, I'm really enjoying getting into this. What I want to do is get some of these public health people who always issue press releases, but then they're never available to talk.
That's because they're drinking their wine.
Yeah, well, it is a wine, W-A-I-N-E.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, people can listen to that on replay if they didn't get it live yesterday late afternoon. All right, let's hit the go button. Olivia, you, because it's been a while, you can go first, all right? And
cheers.
Yesterday morning we had Winston on, and he, you know, no treaty principles, no such thing, not supporting any of that.
Yes, I heard him.
Yeah. Okay, what say you about this?
Well, one of the things that I'd like to just draw attention to is many people may remember this, but Winston had his principles of the Treaty of Waitangi deletion bill back in 2005, where he was fighting on the front line of the affront that this baked-in racism has become to us. He attacked it as a blending of powers between the judiciary and the government, which is a no-no in a modern democracy, or at least is meant to be. Winston's position has always been that there are no principles regarding the treaty at all, because it was a treaty document with just three clauses. It seems that he thinks David Seymour's method of addressing the very real problem of reverse racism now bound into New Zealand law and bureaucracies is to give it a currency that it doesn't deserve in law. as a precedent, because the whole thing crept in without referenda via insertion into other legislation, the Treaty of Waitangi Act of 1975 and the State-Owned Enterprises Act in 1986. So getting back to Winston's 2005 bill, the deletion bill, which nobody supported back then, there was a quote from it that goes, "This Parliament should do New Zealand an invaluable service today. When considering the so-called principles, we must start from the premise that Parliament created this historical anomaly. So it is Parliament that must correct it. We must also ensure that it is clear that this is not an attack on the treaty itself, but on the insertion of the terms, the principles of the treaty into legislation," unquote. So, I mean, I'm thinking the next election is in 2026. So that's when David Seymour's referendum would take place if it was supported, which it doesn't look like it's going to be. That's years away. And there's also the issue that giving a referendum to New Zealand during such a chronically woke cultural low point is actually quite dangerous.
Risky. And could,
yeah, risky, because it could backfire, especially with our horrendously skewed media fronting it. Would it be something that would bind the crown or just be changed from parliament to parliament? So, but here's my question for Winston. What is he doing in this area that is a better idea than what Seymour is proposing? I'm not sure on that, given that for Winston to approach it as a legal undertaking throughout all our legislation and bureaucracies would be a monumental undertaking that is not even talked about at this stage. I mean, will he do another treaty deletion bill?
Deletion 2.0.
Yeah.
It'd be that hard to do, Olivia. You just write a simple bill that says any references to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi in any legislation are to be removed forthwith. End of story.
Well, that was easy.
But how do you act that? How do you act that out?
It's just
by one command.
You enact this law that says to remove this from every other law. So somebody's going to have to do some homework and list out all the laws that mention this, and then you just add them refer to Appendix 1, these laws. It's not hard.
Well, I like the idea, and if it's not that hard, why hasn't it been done? Why isn't it being talked about?
Well, because in 2005 he was in with Helen Clark, and since then we've had, of course, the Ardern regime, and they're woke as hell, you know, wetter than an otter's pocket. And
I was waiting for that one.
Do all of that. And then, of course, John Key didn't do anything because he sold us out to Maori interests back then when he agreed to these ridiculous things with Tariana Turia and Peter Sharples. I mean, UNDRIP happened because of John Key, because he believed that Peter Sharples was right and that there's no Indigenous people in New Zealand, so go ahead and sign it. Well, that was the start of the decline right there.
Lee.
G'day. I'm a cigar smoker, and there are no principles in the Treaty of Waitangi. So just in case I get cut off after this.
Okay, see ya.
Yeah.
And I agree, Lee. Yeah. And this is one thing that I was talking to somebody yesterday over a cup of coffee, and they were saying, oh, why won't – and I even wrote about this, right? And then I thought about it a bit more, and I thought I was wrong, because I said to – when Luxon, went to Rangiwaiwai and said, oh, no, we're not going to support this, and Shane Jones said, we're not going to support this. I said, why can't we have the debate? And I believe that we should have the debate, but I've rethought that in the last few days, and I've thought to myself, hang on a second – what's the worst thing that happens in New Zealand with legislation? You get bad law introduced, and then 10 years down the track, someone uses that bad law as a wedge and expands it exponentially. And that's the risk we have with David Seymour's bill, that we have this treaty principles bill. It gets passed into an act. We have a referendum. It then gets in. And 15 years later, we get a bunch of woke wombles in Parliament and they decide to amend that treaty principles bill, and hello, we've got trouble.
Yeah. I just want to say there is one principle in the Treaty of Waitangi, and that is that the Maori chiefs ceded sovereignty to the British Crown in 1840 and we became one people. That's it.
That's end of it. Story,
and,
right?
Yeah,
end
and
of
even story. Luxon is on record for admitting that now, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
And an x-ray and found he's got a spine.
Lee, you had some experience, decades ago now, the treaty settlement at Tooronga Waiwai, working with Tainui. Maybe you could tell us about that and give us the dimension of that in talking about this issue.
Yeah, I'm Tainui Waka, so that's four tribes, Ngāti Maniapoto, Waikato, Hauraki, and Ngāti Raukawa. So the two tribes I'm connected to are Ngāti Maniapoto and Waikato. In 93, I started university in Waikato there, and I was an intern there in the preparations of the drafting of the first settlement in 95. So it was Waikato's settlement in 95. So from 93 to 95, I was involved in the consultation and the negotiations. So the chief negotiator was Robert Mahuta. So that's Nanaia's dad. So I tagged around and made the cups of tea, listened closely to him, listened closely to Te Ariki Nui. It was the Māori queen. So I'm Kingitanga. And so at that time, I was coming of age. I was 17, 18 years old, and I was listening to all the kōrero that was going on. So what was made clear to me is that I was on a consultation round with Sir Robert Mahuta, going around discussing it with the other tribes prior to the settlement. And he made it clear that whatever happens here, it may affect them. And throughout that whole process, I was trying to understand what was going to happen afterwards, because he and his elder sister, Te Ariki Nui, made it clear to me that once this is done, get on with your life. The most important thing to me as a youngster I can recall then was the drafting of the document, which had nothing to do with principles. It was all based on the articles of the treaty, but more specifically, eyewitness accounts of the land confiscations and the murders. So we had a lot of kaumātua from those that had written records of what happened in the mid-1860s when the land confiscations occurred. So that had nothing to do with the Waitangi Tribunal. It was just to do with basically the text of the document. Mm. And then the settlement was based on the text. So I was taught, you know, as a youngster, as textualism is really important, the words that are written on the paper, not what some white professor is going to teach some law students and then they'll become Supreme Court justices or go on the Waitangi Tribunal. So it was completely separate from all of that. But she recognised at the time, what am I say, she, Te Ariki Nui, she was the driver behind the whole thing, as that she recognised that the purpose of the whole thing, and she made it clear to not just me, that I was a part of there was a lot of interns, youngsters working at the time, and she made it clear, once I sign this, once we get this done, that's it. Move on.
Like moving on, right.
Yeah, be productive. So she spoke of, instead of principles, and she spoke of deliverables. So I had to get a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in science and economics. I had to report back to her with the thesis. I had to hand it over. So I was on scholarship there, but I wouldn't have got paid my scholarship unless I delivered anything.
Deliverables.
And so what's happened here now, 30 years later, next year's the anniversary of that first settlement. What's happened now is, I think if I was her back then and Sir Robert at the time, I would have said, looking back in hindsight now, what hasn't worked, what did work was the idea of getting your people off their backside and getting education, get jobs and move forward in your life. That was a no-brainer. But what we didn't look at closely enough, which is pervasive now, which I've been in the academy for 30 years now, there wasn't hardly any of the wokeness that we have now that there was then.
Okay.
So we could actually say, get an education, you know, be productive. But now, to me, the universities are just woke factories. It's just,
wow.
It's nothing more than that. And this is coming from a former head of school and dean. I've been in the tertiary sector most of my whole life, my career. So what's changed is, and then if you see the comparison there, what happened at Tūranga Waiwai this week, I was literally where Luxon was standing, handing over my master's degree to get my scholarship where he was standing. That was 30 years ago. What's happening there now? Nothing.
Mm.
And so my message, I suppose, to the audience is back in those days, there was all these good intentions. And I think Bulger and Doug Graham had good intentions as well. They knew that votes were on the line. But And they took a step out there. But what I'm saying is that heritage there, that mentality there, the driver behind that whole thing is almost entirely gone now.
Like erased.
Yeah. It was about productivity. Like I'll give you an example. When I did my undergrad degree, it was in science. Now, that was between 93 and 95. Then after 95, Bob sat me down. Sir Robert said, hey, now, look, I want you to look at how Tafiao set up our bank in the 1885. I want you to look at how we can trade with Japan and set up some eel farms in Waikato. Because Tafiao at the time in the 1860s, we had about 14 flour mills in the region there.
Okay.
So it was all about productivity. Now it's just about, like what they said, what Tuku and Rahu and them said this week, you've thrown us under the bus.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's all lies, mate. They're the bus. The tribe itself is the bus.
Okay.
So they have just, the leadership is almost completely gone. And so I'm...
Well, that's sad, isn't it? That's sad.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad though now that we got this forum to be able to speak about it.
Yeah.
Because the majority of Māori don't give a damn about this.
Yeah.
They want to pay the bills and get the groceries.
Like everyone else, right?
Everybody else. And then, but that was the mentality then. It was about moving forward, being productive. And so I completely denounce everything that was said by at Tūranga Wawa this year. They're all lost.
All of them.
The politicians on one side are just no different to the politicians on the other side. There's tribal politicians and state politicians. They're all just the same. And, you know, so...
Oh, dear. Yeah.
I just think... I'll finish, but on David Seymour's angle on the whole thing, I think the only option he's got is just to withdraw confidence in the government and then they'll call a snap election and they'll probably lose, but he'll pick up seats off National and New Zealand First. If he was on his own, I think he would have done that. He refused the cabinet position. When was it? When Key offered him a cabinet position, but he was the only one. But there's another 10 of them in there now saying they've got cabinet positions. And I don't think David would have the sway like he would have back then. But other thing too is this. When you got someone jamming a spear in your face and you walk up on the path, Luxon's going to say whatever they want him to say. And so if I was Seymour, I would have turned up and said, nah, let's have a snap election now.
Yeah.
And let's vote now.
It never works politically, right? Because you've brought down the government, so you get punished by the electorate. It would decimate ACT if they did.
Yeah, but look at the alternative, man. I mean, who wants to go there?
No, the alternative is to say exactly what Lee said. There are no principles. Shut the hell up. Get on with doing something rather than caterwauling and whining and crying like a bunch of spoilt children, and get on with it, right? We've had the settlement process. It's largely completed, but for the intransigent morons in Ngāpuhi who just refuse to negotiate on anything, they're fighting amongst themselves, different hapū and the different iwi that are up there. They're all fighting with each other. That's why they can't get a settlement. Just move on, right, and ignore them. Don't entertain this idea that there are principles in the Treaty of Waitangi.
But don't people then throw the toys out of the cot and go crazy? But who?
I mean, honestly, the Māori Party gets 3% in elections. So who? You know, this is the trouble with being woke. This is the trouble with Luxon being wet, right, because he hears some bad press. And he goes, oh, no, we're not like that, which I was really pleased to see him stand up in Parliament and actually say it out loud. I mean, it nearly floored me. It almost made me, and that's a hard thing to do, to make me speak.
What did it, sorry, Cam, I missed it. What did it make you do?
It nearly made me speechless.
Oh.
Boy, that's pushing the envelope.
All order.
Right? He didn't say it with conviction, though, did he?
Oh, but he said it. Right, and he repeated it, and then Winston gave up and gave him an assist. So what we're seeing here is two parties that have realised there's danger in having a bill that talks about treaty principles, because sometime down the future it'll get altered and adjusted. It's better off to. I can see what Winston's strategy is right now. It's all about the next election,
and
really wants there to be a massive fight about this and about the tree, because he's reading the tea leaves. He's listening to people like Lee. He's listening to people on the street, and they're saying, we've reached peak Maori. We're over it, right? It's beyond ludicrous now. All of these, you know, revisionist history of what went on and what didn't go on. And the words are what the words are. And even if you look at the Maori version of the treaty, there's no principles in that. So there aren't.
So even entertaining principles is kind of danger territory, because then you can, it sets a precedent. There can be more principles added to it, and it could ever just grind
grow,
on, right?
Grow and grow and grow.
Started making references to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. It was just a slogan at the time. Oh, well, we're going to, you know, honour the principles of the treaty. Well, nobody said, hang on, there are no principles.
Yeah, wait on.
And now it's grown a life of its own, and the majority of New Zealanders are over it. They're seriously over it.
Mm.
And if Luxon wants to be wet and go to an election with that, good luck to him.
All right.
I'll throw one more thing in there.
Go, Lee.
I agree with what Cam said at the beginning too. That my concern isn't so much about the idea of the principles or where they are. Everyone can have an opinion on that. What I want is democracy to happen. So I'd like a referendum, because I'd like a referendum on a lot of things, you know. It's not so much what's best or what's right. We could all have an opinion about that, but it's really about who decides, you know. And so if we say, well, we can't have a referendum because it's going to annoy too many people, you know.
Well, but the point about the media, though, I mean, how's it reported? How's it framed? How people?
Yeah, well,
you know, it's dangerous territory potentially, isn't it?
If the first question is, are there principles or not? Here's the referendum. Are there principles in it or not? So we can have a vote about that. But I think what I'm saying here is that over the last 30 years, none of it's worked. So you can have an academic discussion about it as much as you'd like, but it's not paying the bills. However, we've got a whole lot of vested interest on either side.
Well, it's paying their bills.
Yeah, yeah. So Tuku and Rahui had to get up at that meeting and stand up and defend their base, because otherwise they'll lose their chairmanships or their jobs. And then, of course, Luxon had to do the same thing on the other side. If you listen to the king, he's sitting right in the middle and he's saying, there are no principles. And he was on a tour around the country. He was down in Aotearoa and they're talking about another parliament. He goes, oh, are you sure?
He's cunning, right? I mean, the truck driver from Huntly is actually quite cunning when you think about it, right? Because he's actually protecting the Kingitanga movement. No, he's not buying into this global pan-Maoriism that the Maori Party is into.
Yep.
And he's the Maori Party and John Tamihere and his grift and all of the nonsense that's around all of that as challenging his mana as the head of the Kingitanga movement. And so he has to fight his corner for that movement, which means that he has to go against the Maori Party. That's the politics of it.
Having been brought up in the movement, as what the Kingitanga is about is more about good faith and unity as opposed to choosing a political side or the other. I hope that the king stays out of it. And if, for instance, if we were to have a referendum, I would hope that he would assist it and help facilitate it. The idea of who decides, let's have a discussion. But he's made the mistake of choosing sides in the past. Rahui was a candidate for the Māori Party, say, back to him. So if he can stay in the middle and just stay out of it, and just and like as Cam said, the Kingitanga was based on the concept of unity, but I think that concept can be maintained in terms of the whole country. So back then it was about the tribes, but now it can be about New Zealand. I hope that's where he heads it and stays away from all the politics on either side.
The Kingitanga movement was hamstrung by tribalism.
Yeah.
Right? Ngāpuhi said, king, not my king.
Yeah.
You know, you had all the South Island Maori saying, not my king.
Yeah.
Right? So it's actually, people don't understand that the Kingitanga movement is a very small geographic area.
Yeah, yeah.
And tribalism is still affecting it to this day. And getting to a Pan Māori situation, I'm not sure that's possible. But if it's going to come, it has to come from the Kingitanga movement, I think, rather than, you know, professional protesters and grifters in the Māori Party.
Yeah.
All right. You mentioned Luxon having a spine in Parliament. Before we get on to talking about international stuff, what did you make of his comments at the local government NZ conference? People have been impressed with him kind of laying it down there.
Well, you know, that's another one. It's like twice in one week. Like on Monday, I called him a coward and lacking spine.
He must have heard you.
And then all of a sudden, the next couple of, maybe he's got some bad polls and he's decided he actually has to stand up.
Oh, there you go.
He's sitting on the fence, he's getting sore testicles. And he's been told by his advisors, mate, the numbers aren't improving. You need to make a stand. And these are the things you need to make a stand on. You know, bashing everyone. No one likes the council that where they live. Can you name anybody who says, oh, we've got a wonderful council. They just do such amazing things, you know, all those road cones and all those, you know, raised pedestrians.
Leaking pipes.
Right. They're just wonderful things. We need more of that. No one says that, right? We all say the council's in the way. And that's what Luxon stood up. This has got to be I'm not a fan of Luxon, right? I think he's an average politician trying very
wetter than an otter's pocket, Cam, I think.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right? But he made this speech, and I think it's actually the best speech he's ever made, if only just because of the reaction from all of the local government people who are upset that he said, no more gravy train.
Yeah, no more ridiculous spending. And he's sitting there in a $180 million convention centre that was built while I was out of Wellington, came back. First look at it, I knew this is a white elephant. What a waste of money. You know, poured down the... And meanwhile, in my street, water pipes are bursting all the time. You know.
Not anymore, you're in Queenstown.
No, well, that yet to be seen. But and talking about line items under spending and fantasy projects, I haven't heard that for ages, got to say. All right, let's move on. Olivia, I'm sure you've been, well, I won't second guess, because I've kind of been hanging off this DNC event in Chicago. I see Big Mike was up there. And did our former Prime Minister make some sort of snivelling appearance there?
I think she had a chat in the back room, didn't she? I haven't seen a big speech yet. But
Okay. Maybe I missed
but
that.
But I haven't watched it much because, well, it's practically unwatchable. But it's such F-grade political theatre with empty seats and everything. And I wanted to say, too, notice that none of the former presidents ever support Trump. The Clintons and the Bushes, they really hate him. So he is clearly the end of the uni party, which is...
good point.
Yeah, a lot of Kiwis here look away from the whole Trump phenomenon because their TDS allows them the luxury of doing that. But MAGA has completely taken over the GOP. And that's a very telling thing and a positive thing because the rhino grip over the party has been broken by Trump. And those kinds of rhinos like the Romneys and the Cheneys, et cetera, they will have no future in the GOP under MAGA. Kami Lala still hasn't laid out any policies outside of abortion. Not taxing tips, which is Trump's policy, actually, that she's copied. She's really got no vision, and she's the puppet version of the leftist, woke, Caligula's horse AI, and it's quite pathetic. Michelle Obama's speech was all hope and change again. We've heard this before.
But didn't they have hope with Joe in there and Kamala in there already? What happened to that?
You'd think that. They're complaining about a lot of things without realizing out of the last 16 years, they've been in charge for 12 of those. And they're, you know, so whatever they're complaining about America that they don't like, it seems to be under their watch that they've created this thing that they don't like. So it's really an odd kind of whinge that they're constantly doing. And did you hear Obama, Michelle Obama say that Kamala was the most qualified person to ever run for the presidency and the most dignified?
What a load of crap. What a load of nauseating crap.
Epic rubbish.
Mm. Yeah, it's a total coup. She's not been voted by anyone. Yeah. She's Lindsay Perigo, I think, has her defined very well, even the laugh.
Kamala.
She ran in the primaries, didn't she, back in 2020, got 1%, pulled out.
She's never achieved anything.
And she said gauging instead of gouging. Yeah, I don't gouging. Even know the words. And the other thing is that now, what was I going to say? There's so many things that come to mind with her. No, forget it. It'll come to me. Sorry.
Well, Komi Lala, they're trying to paint
Komi
her.
Komi Lala.
They're painting her as the joyful warrior marching toward, you know, forward into battle, whereas I just see a very shallow alcoholic who forces laughter out of her gob every few minutes to buffer off a multitude of sins. And Michelle Obama.
Like getting to the top. How did that happen?
Yeah. Quite Michelle Obama there. Really loves the term go higher. Remember when they go high, when they go low, we go high. She keeps saying this and it's unbelievable. The only high they know is drug induced and they are actually the worst bottom feeders in politics and culture. It's all dirt on people and blackmail. So I don't know what, you know, other than drug highs, what high she's talking about. The Clintons hate everybody. The Obamas hate everybody. And now the Bidens hate everybody because they're ousted. So there is no love in that party, but they're trying really hard to hype up this pantomime of unity. But I just don't think it's...
I know what I was going to say before I lost it before, is that whenever they say anything, the crowd goes wild. And, you know, they don't even say anything. Well, you know, and they're like...
Yeah.
Is there someone holding the signs up saying applause now or something, you know?
There was a spectacular piece of race baiting Michelle Obama did with regards to Trump. She said, I want to know who's going to tell him that the job he's currently seeking might just be one of those black jobs. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine if anyone else said that the office of the presidency was a white job? If anyone said that, you'd be held down forever. So it really is quite awful. But
and what is it with having abortion, mobile abortion clinics and vasectomy clinics parked outside? I mean, hello.
Unbelievable.
A good idea to sterilise Democrats.
Yeah, look, I mean, they've got no nuts anyway, the men, so.
Too late, already happened.
On this whole thing, right, there's a lot of rah, 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 and you've got, you know, various different numerous partisan commentators thinking that Kamala's the next coming of Christ. But Ezra Klein, who's, again, pretty woke, pretty liberal, at the New York Times, his podcast, The Ezra Klein Show, has an episode called Democrats Don't Think They Have This Election Won. So if he's – I follow what Ezra is saying. Like, I don't agree with his politics, but he's usually pretty rational. That's a really good podcast to listen to on the Ezra Klein Show. Democrats don't think they have this election won, and it's probably the best explanation of the makeover of the DNC that is going on now to, you know, as a result of the coup against Biden and installing Kamala Harris. And it's worth a listen to because you'll get a bit of an understanding. And also go and look at Nate Silver's polling numbers from his latest post on his Substack, where he's saying, well, hang on a second, things weren't rosy under Biden and they're not any better under Kamala Harris either. So these headlines, he doesn't think they're actually solid.
Cam, did you see that address that Michael Moore made?
Oh, I don't listen to very much that Michael Moore.
What did he say?
Vote Trump.
Oh, really?
Unless it was AI. I mean, this is where you really need...
He did
a massive speech basically saying that Trump is for the working man.
That's a turnaround.
Yeah. So if you've got Ezra Klein saying that, well, what he's saying, and then Michael Moore basically capitulating to vote Trump, that's pretty amazing.
Lee, you've got something. Lee, you want to talk about this as well?
I think I'm imagining what it would be like if we didn't have X, or we didn't have podcasts, eh? How this all just got shot through. And you put Biden up, you know he's going to look like an idiot, so that's an excuse to get rid of him, but not too early. So Kamala, reduce Kamala's option to be able to speak at all. They'll just be banking on her not saying anything and just getting to November. Because if she opens her mouth and starts coming up with, I don't think this Tim Walz thing was a Democrat choice. I actually think she had a say I think she actually made a decision. So I think for, I'm thinking about, it's been such a revelation for me since 2016 about getting access to information, actually seeing what's going on there. There's nothing more undemocratic than the Democratic Party.
I know.
That's right.
And how will we know that unless you saw through the whole
thing? Not elected, no interviews, no policy statements or program, nothing.
She can't even say
supposedly Democratic.
She can't even say on day one because it's like a day 1,000 for her. So she can't even say that. But I think it's because this. I think the legacy media will just hold on for dear life, and just hope that Musk doesn't do too much with it.
Well, he's already destroyed them.
Yeah. So
on the numbers,
I just think, just thank goodness for all of the access to different forms of platforms and media that we have now. Otherwise, it's so diabolical as you look through it, eh? It's so opposite. Everything they say is the opposite to the truth.
Absolutely. Well, what about Joe's angry rant late at night? I don't know what he was on that night, but it was saying ridiculous things like, we stopped Russia invading Ukraine in 3 days. What, with 40,000 troops? Really? They're going to invade? You're dreaming, mate. You're in a fantasy. I mean, it's just BS.
When he said that it was the Russians who blew up the pipeline.
Turned out to be.
Have you seen, there's a video on Rumble of all these media people go, oh, no, it's the Russians. Of course, the Russians. It wasn't the Russians, right? It was Ukrainians.
Yeah.
In cahoots with the CIA and United States. I mean, Biden said multiple times, we will stop Nord Stream 2 however we can. You had, multiple letters saying the same thing, and then it blows up and they go, it wasn't us.
Yeah.
But isn't an attack on a NATO country, doesn't that invoke Article 5? Where everybody piles in, that was an attack on a NATO country by a foreign entity not in NATO. So that the missile should have been raining in on Ukraine after that.
Well, everything's just on its head now. No ordinary laws apply anymore. But have you seen that there's a 292-page report from the House Oversight, Judiciary and Ways and Means Committee, which shows that Biden has engaged in impeachable conduct, enriching his family through funds flowing from businesses in the Ukraine, Romania, Kazakhstan, and China, with $27 million since 2014 from these foreign entities. And just one dinner with one Russian oligarch saw them paid $3.5 million wired to their accounts straight after. This impeachment inquiry has been going on for months. And, I don't know why Republicans have taken this long to pull stuff out.
Well, maybe they've got stuff that they don't want out as well, because look how the whole machine's funded.
Yeah. But meanwhile, you've got Trump going around the country saying things like pledging to reinstate soldiers in the armed forces who were mandated out because they didn't take the vax. And he wants to give them full back pay as compensation, as well as a formal apology. You know, really good policies like that. Well, the Democrats are just, I don't know, they seem to be suiciding, but I always think that about the Democrats and they never quite die.
sure. Okay, Cam, go.
Yeah, and he's a lock for Kamala Harris. Every article, 15, 16 articles, I think that must be AI or it's an old version of him saying vote Trump. I just don't. There's no way. When you read his Substack, there's no way he's on.
Yeah, it surprised me to hear that.
So you reckon it was AI? It was a talk. It was a audience there and everything. So it could be AI.
I think it's old, actually.
You never know. Should we talk about the UK and two-tier Kia and the operation. What is it, Operation Something Dawn?
Early Dawn.
Or Early Dawn. Don't you hate those names that they give these things?
Yeah, look.
Prisons, like Cobra.
It means prisons opening up for patriots as he makes room by releasing criminals. So listening to Stalin, Starmer blame the previous government for no prison room while he runs around arresting people en masse, like the fascist little feck he is. Operation Early Dawn, emergency move to avoid prison overcrowding. It's unbelievable. I can't believe we're watching Britain do this. But there was also a scathing inspection of HMP Wandsworth in southwest London, which is a prison, also revealed chaos and appalling conditions stemming from poor leadership at every level. This is the complaint that Keir Stalin Starmer made. So to free up space, Justice Secretary, how's this for a name, Shabana Mahmood, who is the Lord High Chancellor of Great Britain, she also plans to temporarily cut the proportion of a sentence that must be served before parole is possible from 50% to 40%. Mahmood is a Pakistani Muslim woman who passionately supports Palestine. In October 2023, she condemned the Hamas attack on 7th of October and said she was concerned by reports of rising incidents of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in the UK. As if anti-Semitism and Islamophobia are the same thing. They are not. So it's expected to mean that 5,500 people being released in September and October from British prisons, and you can betcha that this is partly why we've seen terrorism in the UK not be called terrorism, but called mental health issues instead. Because if they were terrorists, they wouldn't be able to be released. And you remember that MI5 admitted that Islamist criminality accounted for 3/4 of their caseload. The prisons are full of men of Islamic orientation, first and second generation immigrants, and a shitload of illegals. So considering the whole Southport incident was the murder of 3 little girls and 7 others who survived by an immigrant, a second generation Rwandan from Wales, I seriously doubt Ms. Mahmood, Lord High Chancellor, the position once occupied by Sir Thomas Becket and Sir Thomas More during the time of King Henry VIII. I really just don't think she's going to be objective. She's a devout Muslim who swore her oath of the office, this high office, on the Quran.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. There do seem to be some very authoritarian women in this system as well, you know, calling for extreme misogyny to be a hate crime and jailable. So
basically, they're going to free a whole lot of Muslims and so that British prisons can, you know, put their patriots in there for Facebook posts.
Make extreme misogyny a hate crime, which you can be jailed for. That's awesome. That's going to clean up the streets no end, you know, arresting all of these people from Islamic countries who practice extreme misogyny on a daily basis.
And the turf haters.
Yeah, I mean, you can straight away get rid of the niqab or the hijab instantly on the basis that it's a hate crime against women.
You really think that'll happen?
No, they won't go for those people, Cam.
No.
It'll be white British patriots that they target and focus on.
Grandmothers with pacemakers.
As we're watching. You know, I mean, I've seen images of Muslims holding swords, yelling at the police, we're going to cut your heads, and the police do nothing. Can't believe it.
Hasn't there been a call to hand in knives and there'll be no consequences?
Sounds like hand firearms and we'll pay you for them. Yeah, and the criminal
never handled that before. Okay, we've got about 15 minutes left. You had something to say about firearms, Cam, I think.
Yeah, I mean, ACT on X has published a selection of email responses for an ex New Zealand Army veteran who
saw those. Yeah,
10 years in Afghanistan, and they've said to him, "Well, you've spent 6 months out of the country." Over various different periods, and we need to account for that. So could you please provide us with a police report from Afghanistan.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Oh,
what's wrong with these people?
To say that you're a fit and proper person. Now, the funny thing about all of this is that Mike McElraith, who's one of the mandarins from the police in what I call the Tari Pukeko, the Firearms Safety Authority, a man who doesn't recognise truth when it is said to him. He certainly doesn't. He said many things to firearms people, and I have records, video records of him saying things to meetings that I've been in that he's gone completely against and said never happened. That guy served in Afghanistan as well. So
really?
Yeah, he did behind the wire, though. He wouldn't have seen any action. No, he's
still like admin or catering or something.
Doing whatever he was doing. But here's the thing, right? They're saying to this New Zealand soldier who spent 10 years in Afghanistan fighting for freedom that he has to go to the Afghan government, with which we have no diplomatic relationships with, is controlled by the enemy that he was fighting.
The Taliban.
Taliban.
And get a reference from the Taliban.
Oh, dear.
To whom it may concern.
This is ludicrous stuff that the police and the Firearms Authority are entertaining, and it just, it's embarrassing, and it just makes me want to hope that Nicole McKee has a recommendation to abandon all of this bollocks and move it out of the police and get it somewhere where it's sensible. I don't say we're not going to ever not have a register. I mean, we've had registers for years for collectors and pistols and those sorts of things, but it's completely ludicrous. I mean, you know, when you do a renewal, you've got to fill out something like 43 pages and suffer a 3-hour interview, and any of your referees have to suffer the same thing, all to, so that you can be a fit and proper person. And then they turn around and treat you like a criminal, like this guy.
Don't they intimate that he might have PTSD from being in battle and being slightly unhinged from that? Is that the implication?
Well, that's what he's saying. He's this is what this guy is saying. He says it's like they've got this idea that I'm a soldier, an ex-soldier. I want to go hunting. I want my firearms license. He said I don't need a firearms license when I was in the military. No. But as he pointed out to the Firearms Safety Authority, he said if I did anything that wasn't fit and proper as a soldier in Afghanistan, I would have been court-martialed.
Yeah.
And I haven't been. So what's their problem? It's very embarrassing, but it shows how ridiculous the Firearms Safety Authority, this empire that's been built by Mike McElraith and his mates to feather their own nest. I mean, we've spent $230 million on this. Yes,
How do you spend that sort of money? Come on.
$130 million building this white elephant that's never going to work. No register in the world has ever worked. The Canadians abandoned their effort after they spent $1 billion.
But how do you spend that money? I don't get it.
Some perspective, right? Do you remember INSIS when the police IT system got out of control, right? And then the national government then had an inquiry and then they pulled the pin on it. And they pulled the pin on it because the projected costs of INSIS was going to exceed $100 million.
I remember, yeah.
Well, hello? This Firearms Safety Authority has more than doubled that amount of money that was wasted on or projected.
I still don't understand how it can be spent. You know, what are they spending it on?
Well, there's hundreds of staff, hundreds and hundreds of staff. It's huge. I mean, you have no idea. Unless you actually have a firearms license and you're buying and selling and doing things like that and interacting with these morons, you don't actually understand how poor it all is.
No wonder the country's going broke.
I've got an insight from another angle. I'm an ex-cop. And when I left the police, I became an armed robbery consultant for a security company. So that's to fly me around the country to go and work with banks and gas stations and stuff. This is in the early, about 2003, 2004. So just put a different insight on the whole thing away from the legislation is to emphasise how unprepared people are to face a firearm, most people. And those who experienced shooters, hunters, I've got the utmost respect for people who have made a life out of it. And I think that's where Nicole McKee's coming from. I think she understands these things. But from the standpoint, if we got to the point where the UK is now and there's violence on the streets, right? And for the average punter out there, dealing with a gun in your face is, for most people, is they wouldn't be
able to. You got to tell us, Lee, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, how do you deal with it? So,
tell us, how do you deal with that? Just quick.
Yeah. So in my training course, I thought, how do I get this in one word? Is C-A-L-M, calm. Not calm down, be calm. Someone puts a gun in your face and you're on the other side of the bank, you don't even talk. You just be calm. And most people will start putting their hands up like this, going, hands up, oh, this is a stick up. You don't do that because it looks like you're going like this with your fists. Calm, be calm. We'd hire an actor to come in and do a false robbery with the CSOs.
Without telling them.
No, we had to tell them. They had to know he was coming. But even if they knew he was coming and I introduced the actor in to go through the scenario with the people, you'll be amazed that even when you know it's an actor, right, you met the guy, he's right there, and then the voice comes up and there's a gun in your face, how people always do the wrong thing.
Wow.
And for me, gun safety, firearm safety and the legislation, if it's based around that, but I just keep thinking about what's happening in the UK right now. And if that should ever happen here, how would people defend themselves or how would people deal with that situation? You know, so there's got to be more education around the whole thing.
Better to spend the money on that.
It's a really good point because most people, when you talk about firearms in the firearms debate, they go, oh, well, we don't have any need for firearms in New Zealand. We've got the police. They'll protect us.
Yeah.
Look at the UK.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right. Exactly. You've got a woke police force.
I think the police are going to defend you and you're wrong.
Yeah. You're exactly right, Cam. Is that when I got called that night, the Pizza Hut delivery murder in Remuera, I was on that night. We got there. By the time I got there, strapped on, had a gun, walked into the place. Oh, we're talking about a half an hour later. The guy was gone.
So
I don't want to say this to alarm people, but I'm just saying is if the discussion is focused around what the reality is around these things, and I think if the minister could be a bit more frank with the whole thing, you know, and to sort of just give people a bit of a shock and just say, hey, you know, if it ever ended up like the UK, what are you going to do?
The minister won't, though, because he's ex-police. He's part of the crew, right? He's part of the gang.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I meant McKee. Sorry.
But, you know, I worked in a bank and we went through security training and all that, and we were always told if somebody comes in and they present a firearm, give them what they want as quickly as you can and as calmly as you can. The sooner they're gone, the better. Then the police and all of the rest of it.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. Implied. But the other thing that with all my training in firearms and I've been doing that over more than 40 years, with firearms, is that if somebody's presenting a firearm and waving it around, there's a very high chance they're not actually going to use it. If someone was going to use the firearm, they don't talk about it, they just do it.
Okay, yeah.
Right? And you don't get it. You don't get a chance to be calm. It's all on right from the moment that gun comes out and it's shooting. But if they're out and brandishing it around.
Yeah. It's more for show, is it?
You're right, Cam. That's exactly right. If when they want to rob a bank, they're there for the money, not you. They don't give a damn about you. They want the money and get out of there.
And the money's insured.
Exactly. The bank's insured. You got no. Don't have to be a hero.
We don't need another hero.
Yeah.
All right, we're up against time. We haven't quite got to the Euro ratbags silencing Musk. Maybe a quick comment on that before we're done in the next few minutes. Who wants to
say something? These Euro ratbags, you know, they think they control the world, but it's a very tiny place, Europe, actually, you know, when you look at it in reality. But these Euro ratbags thought that they would interrupt an election campaign in the United States by warning Elon Musk for daring to have an interview with Donald Trump.
Because it was dangerous to the discourse.
Of course, Elon Musk reacted in the most Musk way possible, involving copious amounts of swear words.
Yeah.
And insults. And basically told them to go F themselves.
It was delicious.
Your face.
But wasn't there a threat to shut them down in Europe, though, like actually shut them down?
The Digital Services Act, it's pernicious and sweeping violation of freedom of speech in European law. That's what they want to do in order to ban X if Musk doesn't obey, and he's not going to obey.
No, he's not going to obey because he knows that if these Euro rat bags tried to shut down X in Europe, you'll have a whole bunch of angry Frenchmen in yellow vests marching in the streets. And Maloney, the Italian prime minister, has just said, this guy's an idiot. You can't say that. You know, and she's standing up. Of course, they label her as far right and insane and all of those things, but she wears a pantsuit better than most other women politicians.
Hillary.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Oh, better than Kamala. She's got the same suit in a million different colours and it's very unflattering. She needs a stylist. Anyway, I digress.
Could be you, Olivia. You could offer your services.
Yeah. I think, you know, they want to shut down what they call disinformation. And I just want to say again, I know our audience are savvy, so they know this, but disinformation just means dissent, you know? Dissent.
Yeah.
So they want to shut down dissent on X. Fat chance.
Keir Starmer said that the riots were because of far-right disinformation and misinformation. And what do we find out today from The Guardian, no less, that someone's been arrested for spreading false information about the riots in the UK, and lo and behold, it's a Pakistani national.
A Pakistani, yeah.
And some people have been saying that Keir Starmer himself could be vulnerable under this law because of his dis and mis and mal and whatever it is, information. So,
become a politician opens their mouth is misinformation right there. Their lips are moving, sound is coming out. Yeah. It's misleading you.
Yeah. All right. Last word for you, Lee.
Here's to alternative media. The more speech, the better.
Mm.
Oh, good on everybody here. I mean, imagine what it'd be like, dealing with all that without platforms like this and alternative media.
With you on that one, brother.
Here's to us all.
Yeah. Nice place to end. Yeah. Unless anyone has any final comments, as the clock ticks away and my producer says, hey, time's up. All right. I want to thank Lee. Thank you, Lee, for being on the panel today. Lee Taituha. Thank you, Cam. No laughing here. Completely straight face on that. Thank you, Cam. Yeah, thank you, Paul. All right, and Olivia, thank you. Good to see you again.
You're welcome, Paul. Good to see you.
We'll
do it all again in a week here at RCR.
RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.